For 40 years, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, aka SFPIRG, has been helping students build communities at SFU. Campus organizations like Out on Campus and Embark developed out-of-action groups at SFPIRG. Action groups are one of the ways that student activists can take action for change. Visit us at www.sfpirg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about starting your own action group today.
This is Bird Note. Do you ever wonder where birds sleep? Let's listen as the last bird sounds of the day recede into nightfall. All birds need to sleep, or at least snooze, during each 24-hour period. Most sleep at night. Birds don't usually sleep in nests, except to incubate eggs or brood young. They search out a place to roost, often selecting the same place night after night. Songbirds find a protected perch, sheltered from rain and safe from nighttime predators. Small forest birds often spend the night huddled together in tree cavities. Woodpeckers cling to vertical tree trunks. Starlings mass into huge flocks that blanket the trees. Seabirds select islands or cliffs on which to snuggle in for the night. Ducks sleep while floating in protected bays. Birds don't actually tuck their heads under their wings to sleep, as we've been led to believe. But a bird may turn its head around and poke its beak under shoulder feathers to keep it warm. It's similar to the way we humans pull a quilt up to our nose during a cold winter's night. Bird Note gives you the sounds of birds every day, and you get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram at Bird Note Radio.
Hi, my name is Taco. I want to say shout out to all the raccoons on campus. You're listening to CGSF 90.1 FM on Burnaby.
It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
In this era of digital polarization and a lack of shared reality and political consensus, we're navigating massive issues. How might we cope with the many different spheres of sense-making and meaning? Our guest today has written a white paper entitled Polarization and the Algorithmic Undertow, Integral and Critical Realist Perspectives. So join us as we explore how to become digitally mature and mindfully intentional in our engagement with the increasingly fragmented social landscape with our guest, Bruce Alderman. Bruce Alderman is an affiliate faculty professor at John F. Kennedy University in the Consciousness and Transformative Studies and Holistic Counseling Psychology Departments. He's the Associate Director of the Blue Sky Leaders Certificate Program at the California Institute of Integral Studies, known as CIIS. His essays and white papers have been published in many prestigious publications and anthologies on consciousness studies. And he's the co-creator, producer, and occasional host of the YouTube series, The Integral Stage. So please join us for the next hour as we explore the downstream effects of digital polarization and what we can do about it. with our guest, Bruce Alderman. I'm speaking with Bruce at his home by remote connection. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Bruce, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to speaking with you.
I'm looking forward to speaking with you, too. And I think that I'd like to start off because I know that you have spoken about this in some other productions. And it's a quote from Penn Jillette from Culture Magazine. And here's a quote. He says, "For 50 million years, our biggest problems were too few calories and too little information. And for about 50 years, our biggest problem has been too many calories and too much information." So, well, tell us about this globally networked information environment that we're in right now.
Yes, it's really remarkable what's happened in the last 50 years. I mean, if you really look back to maybe 100 years, radio and television and how the scope of what we can be exposed to informationally has been gradually expanding. And then with coming of the internet in the 90s and going forward, and as that's grown over the last, couple decades, it's really situated us in a place that we have not evolved to handle well or cope with well. We've spent most of our species history in environments where the information that we were exposed to was mediated by our senses in our local environments. Gradually, we developed literacy and books, and we could be exposed to wider worlds through that. But nevertheless, it all moved relatively at the pace that we inhabit as embodied beings on the world. But now we're ending up in a place that I would call the information, or kind of the digital noosphere, where it's a digitally mediated environment of decontextualized and disembodied information that is around us in a cloud. And it's really demanding, I think, on our skills at many different levels on how do we navigate this constant flow of information from all directions, from all corners, and often in the form of headlines or sound bites or things that are decontextualized. And so they can disorient us. They can be, triggering of the amygdala and our responses that flare up, but we don't have a way to realistically situate all of that the way that we did. And so there's great demand on us to grow responsibly to handle this kind of information overload. And of course, the calorie overload is another story. I've been learning about that very well as I've crossed 50 and have been growing in size.
Well, you use the word undertow in your title of this particular white paper. And that's a very powerful word, the undertow. So you're suggesting that it's, as you just said, it's really we're immersed in this and it's taking us downward. In other words, an undertow is not a good thing, so to speak. We have to be careful of that. And also it's how we're herded into bubble filters. Am I describing this maybe correctly? What would you say about that?
Yeah, that phrase came to my mind as I was talking to some friends just about especially the political and cultural polarization that we're encountering in our circles, even circles that are dedicated to holistic, integrative approaches, wanting to be as inclusive and broadly orienting as possible, even there, finding these ruptures, this fragmentation, these tendencies towards polarization. And there are old phrases, that are familiar now for people who've grown up in an internet culture about filter bubbles or echo chambers or things like that. And what I felt with the word algorithmic undertow is that it's not just the fact of being in an information circle that that filters information out or that just only reinforces our own views, but actually being involved in, you know, algorithmically mediated technological systems that channel what we hear and what we're exposed to and what we interact with in particular directions that is immediately responsive to our choices and our reactions. And then it pulls us in particular directions, and often for underlying reasons and goals that are not likely our own.
Well, can you give an example of that to help us really visualize what you're saying there?
Right. Well, you know, they talk about the attention economy, and, you know, so there's a interest to get us to look at things, to click on things, to engage with things. And what's most effective for doing that are things that trigger us emotionally, get an amygdala response and have us, you know, interact with it, because that's just money. That's money for the organizations or the corporations that are putting this out in terms of the digital architecture and infrastructure and all of that. So just think about, you know, what happens if maybe just as an example, right? Just to show where we might notice this in action. You're on YouTube, you're watching some things on YouTube. Maybe you click something that's out of the ordinary that you don't normally click on. But then a day or two later, you start noticing that you're being shown things that, why am I seeing this? This is not what I'm interested in. And because you've made a choice that now puts you in a different association circle, that the algorithm is going to start feeding you that information. And so if you engage with that, I've done that experimentally where you just engage with those things. And pretty soon, a couple days later, you're in a completely different media environment. You're being shown very, very different kinds of stories. And the argument here is that a lot of the time that that's happening just unconsciously. We click on things and we get pulled into these curated bubbles of you know, things that are anticipated to engage our attention and therefore translate into money.
Well, in talking about that, how it just reminds me of the fact we're all looking for trustworthy information. And it's hard to distinguish what is truly trustworthy. What's your advice about that?
I think that is hard to give advice on because it's a growing edge for us culturally, I think, especially with AI and with deepfakes and everything that's coming forward. We are more and more going to be in an environment where we could be surrounded by, you know, manipulated information and outright fabricated videos and other kinds of things, that it's going to be increasingly hard on our own to do our own sense making. And so part of, I think, what we're called to do is to technologically solve for some of that, to build in mechanisms that will identify manipulation or things like that that can serve as a stamp of authenticity on certain things. We're going to have to develop mechanisms for that. But there's also just what we can get into later about our own individual mindfulness practices around how we engage with material and deliberately expose ourselves to multiple points of view so that we can see where maybe we are actually being carried along in a narrow band of information, and we need to exercise multi-perspectival, flexibility and I guess you would say integrity.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking as we were talking about having the old-fashioned good housekeeping seal of approval. Back in the 50s it was called, and when somebody had that seal, they could count on it as being a good product of some sort. And I was also rather amused, but surprised, when I read something about Elon Musk, who created the AI chat box called Grok, And Grok started to challenge him on his own truthfulness. And that just made me kind of smile and think, wow, it's turning, his AI chat box is turning on him in some ways. But it's, that just brings up the whole idea of AI actively absenting something. So please talk about what that means.
Yes. This is coming from critical realism, and maybe we can talk about that a little bit more later. But critical realism is a philosophical approach, an analytical approach. And one of the ideas in there is the dialectic of presence and absence. And, you know, there are things that are present to us that we're aware of and that we engage with. And then there are things that are not present. And we normally just ignore what is not present. But one of the arguments with critical realism is that there are social and technological and other mechanisms in place that actually deliberately absent things, or sometimes inadvertently absent things, meaning cut them out of our interactions, cut them out of our awareness. And not only is that a gap, but that actually is causally impactful, because the fact that that is missing changes how we make decisions, changes how we relate to each other, changes what we see and perceive and don't perceive. So just as an example, for instance, you know, if you are following, you know, pulled along by the algorithmic undertow into increasing increasingly alarm raising kinds of stories, and what gets absented as you follow that out is more moderate or balanced views. You're either seeing this extreme view or that extreme view, and the views that are able to hold the bigger picture are not often surfaced. And in that not surfacing those moderating kinds of views, we become much more likely to polarize and to fall into us-them dynamics and that sort of thing. So just the similar when we notice, you know, sometimes people become mindful of that when we're interacting online with each other and we're reacting to each other and writing things. And what's been absented there is the subtle embodied presence to each other, watching what's happening as your pulse quickens, as your eyes, you know, shift, and the whole embodied relationship with each other, where if we were in the presence of that, we might moderate what we say. We might be able to see things that are apparent to us that don't only come through the words, but that we see the fuller picture of the human presence. And then we would react differently. We don't notice that that isn't there. And then we just fall into these reactive patterns.
Well, that just reminds me, in AI is language based. And it's also backward based. In other words, it's collecting all the information that has been said about a subject. But it's not what one might call an actual creativity. It's not generating creativity in that way. That if people are, let's say a student is writing a paper and they use AI and everybody uses the same question, and so they all turn in the same paper. It's just like, and they're not adding a bit of their themselves. And also, as you say, I think that Zoom is helping a bit, because you and I are on Zoom. We can feel each other's facial expressions and so forth. But in strictly printed AI on the screen, you're not going to see those inflections, that personal contact. And that's something that's missing there. And we need to realize that. Do you agree?
Very much so. And the fact that we often don't miss that is what, you know, critical realism is pointing to as something that's not only just a gap, but it's actually something that's changing our culture and changing the way we interact. It's having a real measurable impact on relationships.
Well, that's a profound statement there. And I'm also thinking, Bruce, about what's absent, let's say, in the conversation in education about what we include about the history of the United States. And so there's a whole dialogue going on about not including certain parts of our history or and so forth. And is that part of the what we're dealing with in this point in AI development?
I think so. I mean, I think there's a, you know, either conscious or unconscious, implicit or explicit recognition that including that information will change the culture that forms around that history. And if you don't like the directions that the culture is taking, then you might want to exclude that. You don't want to recognize that because you want to be able to live within your safe digital or informational or other kind of illusion.
I'm thinking about other inflection points in our history. And I think of two in particular. One goes back 7,000 years, and it goes back to, and we've done an interview on this with Leonard Schlein about the alphabet and the goddess, I think mm-hmm. it was called, his book was called. And he talked about when the alphabet was first developed, and it shifted the oral tradition of passing information and dialoguing with people. So that was one, that was a big inflection point. Another was the printing press, because prior to that, everything was handwritten manuscripts, and there would be very individualized writings, you know, handwritings, and the way somebody would do an M would be different than another person doing an M. And, yeah. and so there would be a kind of visceral contact you would have reading a handwritten manuscript. Then the printing press came and all M's look the same. Mm-hmm. So that's another kind of inflection point. Mm-hmm. Do you have any comments on those?
Yes. I mean, I think we're very much at such a point right now, and even a little bit further ahead, people are talking about the singularity where the tools that we're creating actually become smarter than us and able to improve themselves and in ways that we can't, you know, that actually surpass our own abilities. And then our fundamental relationship to our technology is going to change. But even now, with the, you know, with the internet and then increasing and social media and then increasingly with AI, we're again in a fundamentally different relationship to each other and information than either we were with, you know, the alphabet or the printing press. There are two things I could make reference to that are not in my paper, but I think are interesting to look at. One, Jeremy Rifkin, who wrote an interesting book called The Empathic Civilization. And he has argued that societies or cultures have fundamentally changed when there have been revolutions in two areas at the same time. And one is energy production and one is communication. And when there are revolutions in both how you produce and share energy and how you communicate. So he points back to, you know, Babylonian, where there's, you know, the irrigation systems that are developed and the cuneiform writing, and that opened up a whole new vista. And then, you know, there's the printing press and then the Industrial Revolution, and those things went together to make our modern era. And he's saying right now, he traces a number of them, but he's saying right now we're at a place where we have the information system revolution, which is the internet and social media. And now we're, if we make a similar move towards decentralized energy, where it's, you know, solar networks spread all out, or where it's not, you know, just like we have now, decentralized information systems spread over the planet with the internet, once that begins to happen with energy, And so both information and energy are democratized. That's going to be the foundation for the emergence of a new civilizational order.
So that could be a really good thing, for positive thing for life on the planet, in other words. I mean, I think it's called post-carbon cities are developed, and agriculture and sustainable construction and global economic transitions happening all over. How can we push it that way? What can we do to participate in a way that moves us in that direction? Because that seems like a very positive thing.
Yes, and some could say that he was writing a little bit naively, in that he was imagining social media, which is allowing us to be exposed to world global perspectives, would then lead to an increase in empathy, particularly if we're also able to share energy and power, and therefore free more people to participate on a similar level of abundance and affluence and all of those kinds of things. That could be a really powerful, that's what he called the empathic civilization, where we're going to have a fundamentally interconnected world, where there's going to be equalization of some of the differences that are there now, and ability to really be exposed to the human family and its richness in a beautiful way. I still think that's possible, but what, you know, maybe he didn't fully see yet is what has happened in the last, you know, 15 years or so, where social media has driven us, especially with the algorithms and all of that, that has pushed us into these directions of polarization and what I'm calling the algorithmic tunnels and digital demi-realities. So my recommendation then is some of the things that I'm pointing at with this paper. I think his intuition that social media and this broad, you know, global sphere of information that we do have available now could be truly generative and transformative and allow us to meet each other as a human family in a way that we've never met each other before. But it's going to take mindfulness of these mechanisms that are splitting us and polarizing us and trapping us within incommensurate information bubbles. And so that's what part of the aim of a paper like this is, to try to think about and orient towards practices that can help us become mindful of the ways that we're being shaped, and to overcome that rather than being victim to that.
Yes, and I want to talk in more depth about those sorts of solutions or sorts of things that we can choose to help us navigate this new landscape. But I would love for you to really talk about how does these algorithms actually shape our beliefs. I mean, they affect us unconsciously and consciously, I guess, cognitively and the structural unconscious. Talk about that, if you would, please.
Yes. I think Bhaskar has a term that he calls, you know, demi-realities. And I use the phrase digital demi-reality in the paper. Bhaskar is the creator of critical realism. And this is not really a new idea. It's a word for something that we can recognize. But the idea of a demi-reality is a worldview, a sense of what the world is, that is self-reinforcing and self-protecting and insulated in some way. And so ideology is like that, or closed belief systems are like that. And we've had those for a long time in our human history. But what he's pointing to with the demi-reality as being impactful is that it doesn't matter if it's true or not. It has real measurable impacts on the world. And so just by sitting within that meaning-making system, we we make decisions that ripple out in the world and have consequences. So I'll pause there for a second, and then we can continue with that.
Yes, because I want to really flesh that out more deeply.